After this admonishment, he felt that he could not pursue the subject of New York, but he could not think of anything else to speak about beyond the subject he had already forbidden the reverend man to pursue. He sat a moment, scowling, then he said, "You're stopping here?"
"At this hotel?"
"Aye."
"No. In fact, my tent is flooded, and I'm taking my breakfast out of the rain,"
the clergyman said. He spread his hand to indicate the detritus of the meal before him, long since cold.
"You see, I have taken rather a long time of it, to make the shelter last."
"You don't have a church to go to?" This was a rather rude question, and one to which Balfour already knew the answer, for there were only three churches in Hokitika at that time. But he was feeling somehow thwarted by the man, in a way that he could not quite identify, and he wished to regain the upper hand, not by shaming him exactly, but by cutting him down to size. The clergyman only smiled, showing his tiny teeth.
"Not yet," he said.
"Never heard of a free Methodist. I suppose it's one of the new ones."
"A new practice, a new polity," said the man.
He smiled again.
"But an old doctrine, of course."
Balfour thought him rather smug. "I suppose you've come on a mission," he said, "to turn the heathens."
"I notice that you make a great many suppositions," said the clergyman. "You've not yet asked the question without presuming to answer it as well."
But Thomas Balfour did not take kindly to this kind of observation. He would not be instructed on the formation of his thought. He pushed his chair back from the table, indicating that he intended to take his leave.
"To answer you," the clergyman went on as Balfour reached for his coat, "I am to be the chaplain of the new jailhouse at Seaview. But until it is built..."
He picked up his pamphlet and slapped it in an explanatory fashion against the palm of his other hand.
"I'm a student of theology, that's all."
"Theology," said Balfour. He pushed his arms into the sleeves of his coat. "You ought to be reading stiffer stuff than that, you know. Hell of a parish you're walking into.
God's people, even so."
Balfour nodded vaguely and made to leave. Suddenly, a new thought struck him.
"If you called it bad news," he said, "I'm going to wager that you were listening for a good long while."
"Yes," said the chaplain humbly, "I was.
It was a name that caught my attention."
"Carver?"
"No, Wells. Crosby Wells."
Balfour narrowed his eyes. "What's Crosby Wells to you?" The chaplain hesitated. The truthful answer was that he did not know Crosby Wells at all, and yet in the fortnight since that man's death he had done little else but think of him and ponder the circumstances of his death. He conceded after a pause that he had had the solemn honour of digging Wells' grave, and performing the last rites over his coffin as it was lowered into the ground, an explanation that did not satisfy Thomas Balfour. The shipping agent was still regarding his new acquaintance with an expression of patent mistrust. His eyes narrowed still further when the chaplain, who ordinarily bore up very well under doubtful scrutiny, suddenly winced and dropped his gaze. The chaplain's name, as Walter Moody would discover some 9 hours later, was Cowell Devlin. He had arrived in Hokitika upon the clipper ship Virtue, which was leased and operated by Balfour Shipping, and which had conveyed, along with sundry passengers, timber, iron, fasteners, many tins of paint, assorted dry goods, several crates of livestock, and a great quantity of calico, the now-vanished shipping crate containing Alistair Lauderback's trunk, and inside that, the copy of the contract under which the bark Godspeed had been sold. The Virtue had reached Hokitika 2 days before Alistair Lauderback himself. The Reverend Cowell Devlin had first arrived in Hokitika, therefore 2 days before the death of Crosby Wells. Immediately upon landing, he had reported to the police camp, where the jail's governor, George Shepherd, wasted little time in putting him to work. Devlin's official duties would not begin until the completion of the new Hokitika jailhouse, high on the terrace of Sea View. In the meantime, however, Devlin might make himself useful around the police camp, and help with the daily management of the temporary jail, which was at that time the residence of 2 women and 19 men. Devlin was to teach each one of them to fear their Maker, and to instill in their wayward hearts a proper respect for the iron cladding of the law, or so the jailer phrased it. Devlin would soon discover that he and Shepherd differed very radically in their pedagogic sensibilities.
Having taken a brief tour of the police camp and praised the style of its management, Devlin inquired whether he might take his lodging in the jailhouse each night so as to sleep among the felons and share their bread. The jailer received this proposition with distaste. He did not exactly reject Devlin's inquiry, but he paused, licked his lip with a pale, dry tongue, and then suggested that Devlin might do better to take up residence in one of Hokitika's many hotels. Shepherd went on to warn the chaplain that his Irish accent might invite demonstrations of partisanship from Englishmen and the expectation of a Catholic sensibility from his fellow Irish. He advised him, finally, to be discerning when choosing his company, and still more discerning when choosing his words. And with this pronouncement, he welcomed Devlin to Hokitika and promptly bid him good morning. But Cal Devlin did not have funds enough to support several months' lodging in a hotel, and it was not his habit, furthermore, to indulge another man's pessimism about partisan displays. He did not take Shepherd's advice, and he did not heed his warning. He purchased a standard-issue miner's tent, strung it up some 50 yards from the Hokitika beachfront, and weighted the calico pockets with stones. Then he made his way back to Revel Street, bought a mug of small beer at the most crowded hotel he could find, and began to introduce himself to Englishmen and Irishmen alike. Cal Devlin was, to all intents and purposes, a self-made man, but because this epithet is rarely used to describe members of the Holy Orders, we ought to clarify its usage here. The cleric spent the present moment in a state of constant visualization, conjuring in his mind the untroubled future self he had determined that he would one day become. His theology, too, followed this pattern. He was a hopeful believer, and to his many disciples he spoke of a utopian future, a world without want. When he spoke, he freely interchanged the language of auspice with the language of dreams. There was no conflict in Cal Devlin's mind between reality as he wished to perceive it and reality as it was otherwise perceived. Such an inclination might, in the context of another man's temperament, be called ambition. But Devlin's self-image was impregnable, even mythic, and he had long ago determined that he was not an ambitious man. As might be expected, he was given to bouts of very purposeful ignorance, and tended to pass over the harsher truths of human nature in favour of those that could be romanticised by whimsy and imagination. With respect to these latter articles, Devlin was an adept. He was an excellent storyteller, and therefore an effective clergyman. His faith, like his self-image, was complete, equable, and almost clairvoyant.